Hello, I'm Billy. With me here is Ahmed Ali. And joining us is Brendan McCarthy, distinguished comic book artist and co-writer designer of Mad Max Fury Road. Hello, Brendan.
Hello there, chaps. How are you?
Not too shabby,
Doing
thank
all
you.
well, thank you very much.
Yeah, pleasure to talk to you. We thought we'd start with asking you, so going right back to the beginning of this film, all the way back to 1982, I suppose, 1981. So you had sort of, in your career at that point, you had being a comic book illustrator, you've been working with Peter Milligan for quite some time, and then working on 2000 AD, I believe. You were starting to build your career as a comic book artist, and then I want to say you found yourself in Australia in a screening of Mad Max 2 Road Warrior, and I think it's fair to say that that kind of blew your head off a bit. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, there's a whole generation of us from that period in my age group who, if you like, what Fury Road is for you guys, Road Warrior was for us. It was the one that we all staggered out of the cinema with that smoke coming out of our head, thinking, what on earth have I just seen? This is amazing. In my case, I turned around, bought another ticket, and went straight back into the movie and saw it twice that evening. Yeah, it was a big influence, and it had a big cultural impact as well. You saw it in pop culture, Duran Duran videos, books like Ridley Walker. The post-apocalyptic nuclear threat was quite big at the time, with Thatcher and Reagan, and the feeling was that the apocalypse was imminent, kind of similar to now, really. And so it had a big influence on me. I also had living, doing what you could now call a gap year and being in Australia, I was very interested in surfing, as in those days it hadn't really reached the UK. And I used to go out and watch surfers all the time, and gradually thought about fusing Mad Max and surfers together in a drowned world post-apocalyptic thing, which I eventually turned into a comic called Freak Wave, which preceded the film Waterworld.
So you're kind of ahead of the curve when it came to Hollywood and Hollywood projects being made decades
Yeah.
on. And then I suppose what happened next in terms of you coming on board into the Mad Max into the universe and actually helping to make the next film was the fourth film, Fury Road, was you contacted George Miller, I believe, and with a letter that wasn't the opening line simply "Whatever happened to Mad Max?" That was the pitch.
No, it was that's true, but what it was is that by this stage, I was the production designer of a computer animated TV series called Reboot, which was a big phenomenon at the time. And we did an episode which was a pastiche of the Mad Max world, particularly Road Warrior. And so I sent a VHS, as it was back then, before the days of the internet, to George with that little post-it note on it saying, "Whatever happened to Mad Max?" And the episode of Reboot, which was the Mad Max pastiche. And then about a few months later, I got a call from his producer, Doug Mitchell, to say, "What is this? This is really interesting. We're going to be in Hollywood, in a couple of weeks. Any chance we could meet you and talk about this? We've got a project we'd like to talk to you about." So I went up to Hollywood and met them both, and explained about CGI, because back then CGI was completely unknown. It was a brand new technology, and Pixar's Toy Story had come out by then, and there was a lot of interest in CGI because each CGI film was hitting really big because the novelty of CGI was big. So you were getting Toy Story, Ants. It was brand new, and everybody was sort of thinking, what the hell is this? And also noticing the box office on it. So George Miller had been approached by Warner Brothers to develop a Mad Max TV series along the lines of Xena or Hercules. Before streaming, you had cable TV, and the cable networks were a bit more open to, violence or whatever. So George was thinking about doing this TV series and wanted to know, instead of doing matte paintings, could we substitute CGI so he could move the camera? So when you do a matte painting, the camera's locked. So I was talking a bit about that, but the conversation quickly spilled into Mad Max and what about that bit in the film? That shot, did you? So I was being a Road Warrior nut. I knew all about. I'd seen all the films hundreds of times, and so. the conversation, I you know, and then I sort of, I suppose foolishly in a meeting where you're pitching for a gig, I said, I don't think you should do a TV series. I think you should do a movie, same amount of work. And a movie's far more exciting. If you were to do an amazing Mad Max film, I think it would just blow everybody away, you know, just get that spirit of Road Warrior rather than Thunderdome into a new Mad Max film, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we were sort of to and fro on that. And he was a bit, oh, I don't know about a film. The thing about a film is that with a TV series, you could go, yeah, I'm looking forward to a Mad Max TV series. But for me, I was more excited by a new movie. To me, Mad Max was a cinematic experience. And anyway, I said to him, look, if you ever think about doing a movie, I mean, I'll never make a Mad Max film, but you might. Here's some ideas and, you know, you can have them. I'll never make a film. So, you know, and so he let me pitch him this idea for a Mad Max film, which involved a guy breeding a girl to produce offspring. In that case, I was thinking about, you know, the extinction event of the human race, a bit like the dinosaurs, it's our turn. And this guy sort of trying to create a human being that was viable, that would live, because so many, by now I was saying the world must be so toxic that most everybody's dying off or they don't last long. So some of the older generation are lasting, like Max, etc., and this kind of warlord character. Anyway, that was, there were other things as well in it, some quite ridiculously silly sci-fi stuff, but I feel what happened is that it kicked him off thinking about it. And then about 4 months later, I got a call out of the blue saying, do you want to come to Sydney and knock some ideas about? I'm thinking about doing a Mad Max film. And I thought, whoa. So I finished up a TV series I was doing called Weirdos, where I was designing it. And it happened to be an animation TV series based on hot rod toys from the 1960s, a bit like the Big Daddy Roth stuff, if you know what that is. So I had sort of hot rods were all in my head. By the time I got to Sydney, the first thing I did was say, right, you've got to have hot rods in a Mad Max film. This is crazy. So out with the dune buggies, and then came the hot rods. So that was almost the first input into the film. And if you've got hot rods, you then got, well, who's driving them? These young kids. Who are these young kids? At first, they were called Necro Boys. And then George, when I left the project, eventually, he eventually changed the name to War Boys. We started growing it from core ideas. Who's this guy who's breeding women? But George told me his idea then, and it was kind of, you know, the core of Fury Road. Well, what he had was, there's a big citadel castle kind of thing, and there's a guy, he's got these wives rather than one girl, he's now got five of them, and he's breeding them to try and create a viable human. At that stage, the warlord still had a kind of motive of trying to keep the human race going, but that got lost really in the final film you saw long after I left. He became more of a sort of a evil patriarch who's just trying to keep his dynasty going thing. So for me, that lacked a bit of moral complexity, because if the girls were, if you like, the future of the human race, and they were wanting to get go, you know, run away from a safe environment, it made it a bit more morally complex. But, you know, that's, in the end, I'm not the director and it's George's baby. You know, we're in the George Miller show here, not my show. But, you know, we just, so for the first year, we just basically, it was just me and George in a room with another guy who was a really good artist called Peter Pound, who also happened to be Australia's kind of like main underground comic artist. His underground comics are pretty perverted, you know, like those 60s underground comics, like, you know, Robert Crumb and people like that. I mean, I think it's quite interesting that George wrote Fury Road with two comic book guys. You know, I'm essentially a comics guy, although I then went into pop videos, animation and feature films, just because I'd got bored doing comics. But, you know, my roots are in comics and Peter's roots are in comics. And so there was George with two, you know, nutcase comic book guys putting in all the craziness, because we were all super fans of Mad Max 2 Road Warrior. And although I was the, you know, me and George basically nutted it out, Peter Pound would be there sort of sketching things. You know, I'd be doing it too. One of the benefits of being a comic book guy is that when you're writing, you're also, I would be designing the things as we went along. And the design of certain things would then feed back into the story. So, you know, that was sort of how the process. So basically, it was just me and George locked in a room for a year. By the end of that year, we had the whole story worked out, and then we'd written a loose script. And then the second year was the storyboarding year. And we brought in another guy after that, funnily enough, another comic book guy, Mark Sexton. And so it's, what was interesting for me was the influence of comic book people on Fury Road. You know, the craziness and the far outness and the risk taking in the design and the understanding of how do we give the experience that we had from Mad Max 2 25 years ago to a new generation like you guys, where you're coming out. If you can cast your mind back to when you first saw Fury Road, you know, you went to the cinema, you maybe had heard it was good, you've seen a few trailers, and then you sit down, you know, that great feeling when the curtains open in the cinema and the lights go down and we think, okay, let's go on the journey. And, you know, I got a lot of feedback from people saying, man, you know, like, it's been so long since I saw a movie that was just amazing and I was in it. I was completely wrapped in it. And by the time I come out the end of the film, I was gobsmacked and didn't have anything to say. You know, that, and that was the feeling we were trying to get, that if you're going to do a new Mad Max film, it has to be amazing or don't even bother to do it.
I mean, that's definitely, I would agree with, like, when I saw it, I'd actually watched that weekend before Mad Max 1, Mad Max 2. I didn't get around to Thunderdome by the time the film came out. And it felt very much like these are two great movies, two more so than one, in my opinion, but two great movies. And then it felt like I was watching a comic book splash page. Almost every scene was a variant cover. And one of the questions that Billy and I were sort of thinking to ask you was, how did, coming from that background, how did you sort of feel like playing in somebody else's toy box? Because you could have gone away and sort of created a Mad Max-ish story. So when you had that opportunity, did you feel like you had a good sense of idea of where you want to go with the character, or was it a lot more dialogue, a lot more, this is, like you said, George Miller's baby, and I'm just here to sort of help that dream come along?
No, George obviously devolved his power down so that we could just be equally creative. You know, we could just, because it was a very casual thing. We weren't sitting around worshipping George every day. We would have disagreements and, no, that's bollocks, what you're talking about. You know, it was a very robust, I've said before, it was more like a band making a record than it was, you know, two writers sitting in a room typing away. It wasn't that experience at all. It was, we were basically standing on our feet all the time. It was, we did everything on these whiteboards where you could write and draw on the whiteboards. We'd write dialogue. I'd do drawings next to the dialogue. You know, it's the whole thing. Then we'd print out what we'd done that day. And there was a giant file of printed out sheets from these whiteboards. And that was the first 6 months where we then sort of had the feel of the whole movie down. And then we spent another 6 months writing a first draft script from these electroboard drawings. We'd pull one out and go, okay, let's turn this into text. We needed a script and we had the designs, because when you're going to storyboard it, everything has to look the same. You can't have five different designs drawn by different storyboard artists for a truck. It has to look the same. So a lot of that design work was, you know, loosely locked in. But, you know, it also then the second year of storyboarding refined, you know, the move. It was basically a very detailed second pass on the script. And so by the end of the second year, we'd done two thirds of the film up to when the third big chase happens. By then I was getting a bit burnt out. And also George was developing Happy Feet, the animated film, because he'd got very interested in the computer animation. I was giving him, you know, lots of tips on CGI, because I'd been working in that field for about 4 or 5 years. So he was developing Happy Feet. He started to get into that while, and at the same time, he was looking for another CGI project to sort of have on the runway after Happy Feet. And he saw one of my projects and said, I'd like to buy that off you and develop it. And so I then, as I say, getting a bit burnt out from Mad Max, I moved off, I took some time off and then came back and did this new project called Fur Brigade, which was going to be the follow-up film to Happy Feet. What happened there was Happy Feet came out, went to number one at the box office the week it came out. Warner Brothers phoned him up that weekend and said, we want a sequel to Happy Feet and you're greenlit. So he now is doing a sequel to Happy Feet. So my thing gets punted back after that. It takes about 4 years to make an animated feature. So once, you know, I had by this stage, you know, we had a full script with loads of images and pictures through the whole script of Fur Brigade, and it was ready to go. And, you know, there was nothing for me to do. I didn't want to hang around. So I just, I sort of moved on and started doing some other stuff. And sadly, what happened with Happy Feet 2, he kind of took his eye off the ball a bit and started getting back into the Mad Max project. And Happy Feet didn't really have the attention of the first one, and it came out and it completely tanked. And he just said, all right, screw this. And then Fury Road gets greenlit. So he says, I'm getting out of animation. I'm going to do Mad Max Fury Road, live action. I'm returning to my roots, etc. And so Fur Brigade got lost in the, and it sits on a shelf somewhere in George's office somewhere gathering dust, which is a real heartbreaker because it's an amazing animated feature film. You know, it's kind of, if you can imagine something like Toy Story, but with the George Miller energy through it, you know, that really, it's a really boisterous boys film. It's not, you know, girly princesses and all that stuff. It's, you know, it's, I wouldn't say hardcore, but it's for boys, you know, age about 12 or something up. You know, adults would love it too. But I don't know what happened to that. I mean, I suppose it's so long ago, I've got to probably accept that it'll never see the light of day. But at the same time, knowing that there's an amazing movie sitting there on the shelf, which I created, I sort of feel like tempted to try and kind of get some interest from a studio and then buy it off George, something like that. I don't know. We'll see what happens. But that's the state of play with all that stuff. But I think I kind of answered your question and went off on a tangent. Sorry about that.
100%. Thank you so much.
No, that's great. I mean, sort of follow that up, Brendan. I mean, just going back to what you're saying about how the script, it was a script, and then, you know, for the first 6 months to a year, and then it was a storyboard, and you were sort of boarding it. And I was just thinking, when I was watching the film again, the just thinking about how it was scripted, the number of sort of great sort of kind of punk lines in the film. There are so many sort of wonderful bits of dialogue, even though it's a film that does not rely on dialogue per se. It's not driven by dialogue. There are still so many great little bits. Like I've written a few down here on my screen. I've got the terminal freakout point. We have become Half-Life. These kinds of things. These sort of great sort of sci-fi things. And I know that it's quite a while ago now, but when if you cast your mind back, when you and George were putting pen to paper and getting stuff down, do you remember sort of coming up with lines kind of like that and sort of having fun doing the actual scripting?
Yeah, I mean, we would stand next to each other and act out scenes, and we would say loads of dialogue that would be rubbish. But now and then we'd hit on a good line and we'd write it up on the board. And it was done, it was very, it was more, as I say, the spirit of how we wrote the film was more like a bunch of, you know, rock and roll people putting together an album than it was, you know, two screenwriters typing away. It wasn't that at all. And I feel that, you know, George was very adamant about saying that the energy at this point that we put in is going to set the tone of the whole movie, right to to directing, shooting, editing. So he was very aware that, you know, look, we had a kind of deal, me and George, that if after a year he's done three Mad Max films, remember, and if he doesn't feel like this is going to blow everybody away, just flush it, you know. I mean, I was very strongly like, a Mad Max film has to be amazing. It can't be Yeah, not bad. Yeah, it was all right. Yeah, you know what happened with all the Alien franchise? You know what happened with the Terminator franchise? So is this going to be another one of them? Just a half-baked sequel that you go, yeah, nice cinematography, you know, or something like that. We don't want that. It's either going to blow you out of your socks or go home and don't bother to do it. So that was, I mean, we were playing for keeps and it has to be amazing. And I can assure you that if I'm doing a Mad Max film, I'm not going to let it be crap. And, you know, I think George appreciated that I wasn't a little kiss ass. And yes, George, that's amazing. You know, I was really holding his feet to the fire, saying my thing was to, I had to read George as a person and make sure I could get him back to that younger, cockier guy who made Road Warrior. Because when George Miller plugs in his guitar and does those Mad Max riffs, something transcendent happens, something amazing happens. He's probably, to me, the finest action director on the planet. Those old guys, those guys from that era, Cameron, Miller, you know, Spielberg with Raiders, there's an understanding of film and action and stuff that that generation has that I'm not seeing in, it, you know, mainly I'm not seeing in newer directors. Like, for example, when you look at, say, a director like Ridley Scott, who is obviously fantastic, you know, he's a genius, and the first Alien is probably one of the greatest films ever made. Ridley shoots action by coverage. He sets the action up in the actors, and then he has tons of cameras around and covers everything, and he edits together through coverage. So it's action through coverage. What we did is we wrote the action. We actually would storyboard and lay out the action, and George would shoot the action that we storyboarded, and then he'd have extra cameras on the fly just to catch stories, to give him some extra editing options. But we scripted all our action, whereas you know, a director like, as I say, I'm just picking Ridley Scott as an example, who directs action through coverage. He puts his action together in the editing room more than actually when he's shooting it. I mean, he does it to a degree, of course. I think CGI has made a big difference as well, because you're seeing with films like The Fast and the Furious, those types of movies, you're saying the level of fantasy they're allowing in their film, you know, in CGI, you know, you can drop a car out of an aeroplane and it'll land perfectly on the freeway, you know. So the laws of gravity are not being observed. It's more, there's a fantasy element in it, which I think is probably the influence of Asian cinema. But with Mad Max, you know, one of the things we established very, very early on was that we've got to do this stuff as real practical stunts as often as possible, because bone meeting metal, which is what you got in Road Warrior, gave you that visceral, holy crikey, that really happened, you know, like you really felt it. Whereas with CGI, there's a softness. You don't really feel it. You know, it's a trick. And so there was a lot of CGI in Fury Road, but it was, in a way, it was the CGI of omission rather than commission. Other than the big scene with the storm whirlwinds, most of the CGI was removing elements like cables and safety harnesses and all that stuff. Look, if you're doing an action movie, you've probably got the greatest action director in the world, George Miller. What we had to do, obviously, the challenge is to make each action scene just discrete unto itself and slightly different to the one. So you don't get what we used to call car sick. There's a monotony to action after a while where you start to get bored with it. And so we had to make sure that the audience didn't get bored because they'd seen it like 10 minutes before in another sequence. So if you notice that the action, the first main action sequence is those spiky buzzard cars attacking, like, we looked at wildlife footage. You know, when you get a big water buffalo and then you get a load of hyenas circling it, what they do is nip the legs to try and take the buffalo down, because it's a bigger beast, then they can pick it off. So if you notice that the buzzard attack is these small little light vehicles coming in with their buzzsaws, trying to take the wheels out so that they can slow the vehicle down, then stop it, and then they can pick it off. So if you like, there was a rationale to the action. And then what George has is the idea of canon the action. To canon it is to take it up to another level. So you've done your buzzard scene, and then we canon up with the incoming storm. And then you go into a different scene where you've even raised the stakes up even higher, because in the previous scene, you've established spraying your mouth means suicide with a bomb. So in the when you go into the storm, once Nux starts spraying his mouth, you know what it means. So that is, if you like, a two-part action scene. So then you get quietness, you've got a fight scene with Furiosa, and then they travel into the canyon, and then you've got a different scene where you've got people bouncing around like mountain goats on bicycles up in a canyon, totally different to what you've seen before. There's a period then when they go into the swamp, and there's a bit of a quiet scene where they're underneath all the stars wondering what to do. And then they turn around and go back. Now, when we go into that scene, at first you feel like, hang on a minute, I've sort of seen all this already. But then there's that amazing shot where in come those guys on the poles. And so yeah, we knew we had that up our sleeves as the new thing that you hadn't seen before. And then that changed the dynamic of that final scene. Once you had those guys on the poles, suddenly the whole film comes alive again. So if you see that there's three discrete action sequences, each one totally different to the next, to keep you interested.
And what's amazing about that structure is that the fact that it allows the audience to breathe, whereas like a lot of action films, they think it has to be at one level constantly. Whereas like, and I think some people when Fury Road came out were like, oh, it's only at one level. And it's like, when you watch it, you realize it's not. It's got the pacing is so well constructed in terms of it knows when to hit you and when to let you breathe and take stock.
Honestly, I stopped doing interviews. This is the first one I've done in a while, because all everybody wanted to talk about was, overthrow the patriarchy and all that stuff. And I'm thinking, well, what about the actual roller coaster ride that you went on when you saw the movie for the first time, when you were, your knuckles were gripping the side of the cinema seat and you were going, fuck, you know, what about that? That apparently is not relevant. Let's talk about overthrowing the patriarchy. And I just thought, you're missing, we put as much work into that roller coaster ride and the structure of it, as you were saying earlier, to make sure that, you know, when we crank you up and then you go on a giant action sequence, we follow it up with a bit of calm all the time, developing the story and the characters, you know. And what we also did was made sure that we had character development inside the action sequences rather than just, here's some characters, now let's do an action sequence. Here's some characters, let's do an action, you know. So the characters are always moving through the action. This is all stuff, listen, I'd never written a giant Hollywood feature film before. And I learned, I was watching George Miller and listening to him like a hawk, because I was being mentored and getting the information from one of the world's masters. Now, he's getting on a bit. And when he kicks the bucket, you're going to lose all that generation of filmmakers, I'm saying, you know, all those 80s action guys, Cameron and Spielberg and George, et cetera. That's a huge sort of massive level of talent that will disappear. And you know, there are good new directors, of course, but I do go now and check out action films just to see what are they doing well and what are they doing badly. And I do find, for example, with Marvel films, I am so bored but halfway through it I'm thinking, how long more have I got? Oh my god, there's an hour and a half to go of this damn thing, you know, that sort of stuff. You know, now and then there's a good Marvel film, but generally I feel that these people don't understand the internal dynamics of engagement, rest. Like, for example, I saw that new Doctor Strange movie and it was just a mess of CGI. And it was like, oh God, you know. There were some good bits in it. Sam Raimi's a good director, but, you know, you've got death by 1,000 executives when you do these films. Everybody's modifying it and putting that bit in, and it's got referred to that TV series from, you know, all that crap. I feel Marvel films are getting bogged down by their own mythology now. I haven't seen the new Thor one. I mean, I think the director is quite fun, you know, the New Zealand guy, but possibly he might be too playful and undermines the drama, so you don't kind of care that much if you're winking at the audience all the time. Do you know what I mean? There's a payoff with that stuff you have to be careful of. There's a line.
Cool. So I think the next thing I wanted to bring up, Brendan, which I'm fascinated by, is what was it like visiting the set in Africa, actually going and seeing, you know, the designs that you'd worked on for years and sort of talked about with George, and seeing the characters, you know, brought to life? What was it like seeing that, the world you'd sort of worked on in the flesh at last?
It was interesting, and you've got to remember, it took I finished working on Fury Road about sort of 2000. So, and it took 12 years to get it made. You remember, I wrote, it was originally the one I wrote, which is about, say, 85 to 90% the film you saw. It's called Fury Road now. It was always called Fury Road, but I wrote the fourth installment of the Mel Gibson Mad Max, is what it was. And then once Mel Gibson had a meltdown, you know, and then also, coincidentally, the film fell apart due to some financing issues. They had to recast it. And Heath Ledger was going to play Mad Max, and then he died. So that screws the whole thing up. And Brad Pitt turns it down, which was, I think, a very bad decision by him. And in the end, you know, you looked around, you thought, well, as George said, in the end, it was Tom Hardy, you know, to get somebody with a bit of that raw masculine kind of quality that, you know, Tom Hardy has that wild quality about him. So eventually, once they locked in Tom Hardy, they could get going again, you know. But that, I mean, you know, it's a great testimony to George Miller's persistence that after all the incredible, you know, it was set up and ready to go twice. And then on the third go, they finally got it made. And originally it was going to be shot in Australia, but they were forced over to Namibia in Africa, which is largely a desert country. And so it was interesting to go out. It was great going down to Africa. I'd never been to Africa before. And it was just, you know, when you go into a place, you pick the vibe up of a, you know, the feeling of Africa was amazing. Really was interesting. And yeah, I was only there for about, you know, just about the best part of a week. And, you know, I wandered about, looked at staff, watched how George was shooting everything, and met a few of the cast and, you know, just hung around, really. Since I wrote and designed it with George, you know, something like I'd started 15 years previously, you know, the designs had evolved, but they were still the same designs. There were still hot rods, there were still polecats, there were still buzzards, there were still... But he offered me production design, but I didn't want to do, you know, I really wasn't interested in production designing. I'm more up the front end of the film. I like coming up with the ideas, the designs, the story, the characters, all that stuff. That's what interests me. I had worked in Hollywood for 10 years previously, so actually shooting films is quite boring because it's 90% of the time is hanging about. And then with a bit of, you know, 3 minutes of shooting and then another 10 hours of hanging about. So after a while, it actually got quite boring. So it was nice to see it all. You know, I was very happy that they invited me out to see it all. And, you know, but in the end, to me, it was the fun was creating it, inventing characters. I mean, one of the things that was shocking to me, I hadn't realized, is that you can be sitting around in George Miller's studio in Sydney going, wouldn't it be great if he had a character who looked like this and he had blah, blah, blah. And we're all laughing, just saying something that's really crazy. And the next thing, you know, an hour later, it's actually in the movie. And I think, crikey, it's that casual. You know, you could just throw something out just to try and make George laugh or something. And it ends up in the film, you know, and you think, wow. So that was a rule. That was one of the biggest educations to me was, you know, don't hold back. Go as far out as you can and even further. I mean, there was stuff that we came up with that was so over the top that we couldn't do. Mm-hmm. And a couple of people complained about some of it, so we took it out. But this was staff. This was internally at George's studio. And people going, oh, come on, that's too much. But now I'm actually thinking, I wish we'd kept it, you know, because why did we listen to that person? We should have kept it in there. You know,
I'm curious to ask now what kind of stuff was left out.
I'll give you one example. One example is there's a piece of the film Fury Road that to me didn't quite, as comedians say, the joke didn't land, meaning it didn't click, it didn't pay off in the movie, which was when the blonde-haired girl who's pregnant, Splendid or Aranka or whatever her name is, she hangs off the door and then the door falls and she goes under the thing and she gets killed, right? And I didn't feel anything. I didn't care. It didn't impact. It didn't make me go, oh no. I just went, why isn't, and I thought, why hasn't that worked? You know, why didn't that land that she got killed? We should have gone. And that's all. When things don't work, it interests me. And I have to roll it over in my head for years thinking, what about it? The original idea we had was she's in the car, does her thing to block a shot at Max because the warlord won't shoot her because she's carrying his offspring. And she goes back inside the truck, but one of the idiot war boys takes a shot and shoots her in the head in the back of the truck. And she basically is dead. And all the girls are, she's pumping blood all over the girls going, what? And all the girls are freaking out. And Furiosa has to do a cesarean on her in the middle of the truck while those guys are going over on the motorbikes in the canyon, and rescue the baby. Otherwise the baby will die with her. And I felt that was a really exciting scene, shocking. But it was too shocking for some of the people that were working in the studio women who said, oh no, that is just it was too much. And we sort of rethought, hang on a minute, maybe this is too much and we're not being, and it made sense to me that they would have the baby and he's after them, because that's what he's after, is the baby. And, and the means obviously producing more babies of the other girls. And so it changed the story. When we changed that, and then you had the scene where they pull the baby out and it's dead and all the rest of it. I wonder, were we better off sticking to the original idea, So it's hard, it's hard. You don't know. But I do know that for me, and I've spoken to other friends who've seen Fury Road, said, did that work for you when she died? And they said, well, it wasn't a big moment, but yeah, it was okay. And I thought, yeah, it should have been a big moment. Mm. And, so I'm just throwing you out, the things that I think, you look from the film from the outside in. I'm looking at it from the inside out. When I see it, I think, right, what worked here and what didn't? And there's other things we had in the film that we didn't put in, which I think, yeah, maybe we should have been a bit more ballsy about sticking with our, guns. But, you have to just, at the time you make decisions and you're not sure. Sometimes you don't, are we getting too far out here? Are we being too safe? The main thing was don't be safe. That was the last thing we wanted. That's an example of something where it could have gone one way, it didn't. And then, but you got the film. The film's the film in the end. Mm,
of course. I suppose, that's really interesting, because following on from that, I know that in the first few drafts of the script, there were a lot of differences. Like, the whole third act at one point with the Vuvuzelani, the female warriors, it wasn't a chase back to the Citadel. It was originally a sort of airborne attack, I want to say. It was the third act was quite different.
Yes. I mean, George didn't want us to have an ending when we were writing, for example, when I met Ridley Scott once to pitch him a film. And he said, the main thing is know your ending, before you start writing. And that was 180 degree opposite to George Miller, who said, I don't want to know the ending. I want the characters to take us there. So that was the thing where what we did is we sort of blocked out an ending, just a sort of rough. So we kind of knew that there was an ending there if we were stuck, or just as a security blanket, really. And we didn't use it. The ending that we had was that the Fury Road was a dead end. It just led to a sheer cliff face. And so you've got Furiosa driving the truck towards, by now they've jettisoned the tanker and they're only in the front part, the rig part of the truck. And they're hurtling towards at high speed down this track towards a sheer cliff edge. And he's got what's left of the armada still pursuing them. And there's a mist covering this escarpment, which is a sort of circular escarpment with a sheer drop. And as she hurtles towards the edge of the cliff, you think they're just going to drive over the edge. She flips the truck, she pulls the steering wheel, and the truck starts sliding sideways. And then she pulls the gears and revs it up again. And just as it slides to the edge of the cliff, what comes into view is a slip road that goes down the cliff. And they started driving down the cliff, wheels coming off the edge and super tense and all the rest of it. But meanwhile, lots of the armada just can't stop and go right over the edge because they don't know that there's a slip road down there. And from this cloud cover came up these, a bit like the gyro captain in Mad Max 2. There was an airborne quality of these women in kind of these helicopter contraptions who came up out of the thing like harpies, you know, in the Greek mythology, the avenging female. Interesting enough, in the title of the new one called Furiosa, Furiosa is derived from Furies, which is the other name for the harpies in Greek mythology. And a fury is an avenging woman. And so what we wanted to do was one giant fuck off fight between men and women. And right, who's going to win? You know, and in the end, they're both devastating each other. And Immortan Joe gets killed. The main leader of the Vavolini is killed as well. And there's a truce. And they basically, what they work out is that, look, the men have got the oil and the armaments and a small green place. But they, below the cloud cover, have a sort of damp climate and have got all this food growing. And so they're going to basically work together and come together and try and, you know, they can provide this, they can provide that and work it out together, which, you know, in the end is what has to happen. You know? But in the end, we didn't go with that. I just remember vividly George walking in one morning and saying, they go back. It's the only green place. And and so suddenly the whole movie sort of pivoted. So we'd taken it right up to the bit where they're looking up at the stars and seeing satellites and, you know, that sequence out in the plains of silence. And we then turned it around and realised, oh, actually, they're going to head back now. They're going to have to go through the entire armada to get to the only green place that we've seen as the audience in the film is on the top of that citadel. So that's how that went. I mean, although, you know, I put up plenty of fight on things I didn't agree with, ultimately, George had the executive. Ultimately, it's his film, you know. But, you know, he psychologically, he was robust enough to, you know, assume the role of not being the boss and the powerful guy and just being like Lennon McCartney or something, you know, just equal, so that we could create equally with each other and not, you know, so he'd say to me, no, that's complete nonsense. You can't do that because of that. Or he'd come up and say, yeah, but that won't work because of that, you know, and you go, oh, yeah, right, you know, or whatever, you know. So, you know, it was an equal relationship because he devolved power down. So he, you know, that there wouldn't be that power imbalance. But when it came down to it, in the bottom, you know, the bottom line is it's his move. It's a bit like I'm on a, you know, an album with somebody who's a big name and I'm writing all the songs with them and putting everything in. But in the end, it's their album. So they get to make the final decisions. So that's fair enough. I mean, I knew that. But in order for it to work between us on a creative level, we had to be equal, even though it was a role play by George.
Yeah. One of the sort of things that you touched on there was the idea of like Furiosa and this sort of the mythology that you guys were thinking about when you were creating her. Is that the way that you work, where do you do a lot of sort of backstory of each character just so you can understand where they're going, who they are? Yeah. Or were you guys, oh, brilliant. I was going to say, you know, sort of to add to that is, did you guys have any other sort of ideas about sort of what a potential prequel, because I know there is a prequel coming down the pike. Was that something that you and George had discussed for that particular character?
No, we totally focused on this film. There wasn't, you know, prequels, sequels, or, you know, it's a trilogy or anything like that, because, you know, you don't know if the film could come out and tank. But no, I think it's a bit of a mistake to think of trilogies when you're doing the first one, because it's going to diffuse your commitment to that film. So we just focused totally on this film has to be a masterpiece. It has to be amazing. Look, we talked about everything. I mean, I would have conversations with George about why can't genre films get nominated for Oscars? We have to make this Mad Max film. I remember saying, George, supposing this film was called Mad Max Apocalypse Now. you know, now Apocalypse Now won loads of Oscars. It was a serious film about serious stuff. I said, why can't our film, a Mad Max film, which is considered a genre, be as substantive and meaty as, if you like, mainstream films? And so that was always our aim, was to create a film that, although purportedly genre, is also going to, you know, deal with issues that are substantive. Once you have a group of women that are breeders, that are basically sex slaves, you then got the whole politics of that. And that's how that started to develop. Now, there was less of that in the version I wrote, and George amplified it he worked on the film for another decade after I left it. So, you know, it would accrue different weights and shift tones here and there and stuff like that. As I say, it's essentially, I recognize the film that I wrote. 90% of it is the one I wrote with George, but the extra 10% was pushing it, adding, say, the feminist element to it. There were, you know, like, for example, we didn't have the name Furiosa for Charlize Theron's character ever when I was writing it. She was called Warrior Woman, the Praetorian. She was referred to that way. And that, to call her Furiosa was like right in front of our faces, because originally the word Furiosa was the name of the land around the Fury Road. They're traveling through the Furiosa. So this word was around, but we'd never connected it to Charlize Theron. So that came later, I think, because what happened after I left, a few years later, George took on another writer. I was in LA at that time, and he took on an Australian writer. And obviously then amplified elements of the film. And around that time is when the obvious name Furiosa got attached to Charlize Theron. The sequel, Furiosa, is a prequel, and the story derived from the backstory we had on Furiosa. I mean, we knew she had been abducted and taken to the Citadel and had come from a green place of many mothers, right? We knew that sort of stuff and a bit more stuff about it. But George then developed the backstory a bit more than, you know, in the 10 years intervening before he got into Fury Road. A lot of it doesn't appear in the Fury Road film, but he got so interested in it. And because Charlize Theron was such a strong character, you know, if you like, the female Mad Max, that, you know, he obviously became interested enough to want to do a film about Furiosa herself. So, I mean, he did ask me to read the script, which I did read just to give him some notes, as we call them, you know, just to say, well, what did I think of it? And I said, well, okay, very good, you know, really rocks along. I think this bit's a bit boring, this bit's weak, you need to think about that scene, blah, blah, blah. You know, you do all that stuff. And I just gave him a, you know, just what we call notes, just, I think you could improve it if you did this. So whether, how much of that he takes on board, I have no idea. I'm not involved in it in the slightest. I'm very happy to have done Fury Road. It's the Brendan McCarthy Mad Max, and I'm very happy about that. I've done one. I've fulfilled a giant tick off my bucket list. So I'm happy with it. But that's 2 years of my life I put into Mad Max. But I think that's enough.
Were you going to ask something, Ahmed?
Yeah, I was going to. Ask that 12 years it took to make the film. How much of that was the touching on this notion of too much CGI? How much of that was convincing the executives, convincing the studio that actually this film needed to be almost practical, almost like a throwback to the first three and that sort of punk style 70s, early 80s sort of filmmaking that in today's sort of scene has become a lot more digital, has become a lot more put people in front of a green screen, save money that way.
Well, even though I'm bitching about CGI and the bad use of it, you do have to look at the box office of, you know, Endgame and, you know, Batman films and all the rest of it. And, you know, they're all sort of happy. The executives are happy as long as the films make gazillions, you know. I mean, Mad Max Fury Road made about, I think, 400 plus or something at the box office. So compared to a billion for, you know, some Marvel film or whatever it is, you know, Mad Max probably, if it wasn't so prestigious and so well-loved by people. It's you know, the Mad Max Fury Road has had a great afterlife on people watching it and streaming. And look at you guys interviewing me now 7 years later, you know. So, you know, I mean, they can roll the dice on Fury Road or Furiosa. They'd probably like another one, maybe get a trilogy before. George is getting on a bit now, so hopefully he'll get three new ones done and they'll all be great. You know, it's all about money. Does it make money? How much does it cost? Or do we get loads of Oscars and do we get prestige? Everything's about money, prestige, and power. That's what Hollywood runs on.
I mean, I suppose we've got a trivial question, but it's a question that I've sort of had in the back of my head to ask this whole time. But, you know, they give, you know, the shit. But, like, you know, so just going back to what the stuff that you designed on the movie, you know, the vehicles and the, the war boys and stuff. I've got to ask, and I'm sure you probably have been asked this before, but the Doof Warrior, the guy with the flaming guitar, was that one of those ideas where you and George are in the room and you're thinking, okay, how far can we run with this? Can we get a guy with a flaming guitar? Was that you guys spitballing that, or was that something that came later?
Yeah, no, that was... I didn't have a lot to do with that specific character. That was George came up with him as a, you know, as you said, like a, you know, a guy who plays the bugle in the cavalry. Let's have a guy playing a guitar as the sort of cavalry bugler, if there's such a word. And then Peter Pound developed the actual look of the character, but his look sort of developed a bit more after I left. So in the case of the guy with the guitar that shoots flames, I didn't have a lot to do with that particular one. So, you know, just to be honest about what I did, no point taking credit for shit you haven't done. But I'd say Peter Pound was the big influence on that. And then you had the production designer who I think added the flamethrower at the end. I think that was how it went. So you had the idea for it. You had it developed by Peter Pound, the comic book guy. And then when they hired the production designer who came in and then, you know, obviously had all the designs on a plate by me, he could then develop bits, extra bits and add bits to them and all that sort of stuff.
I was going to say sort of like to sort of touch on that and sort of how come you guys sort of moved away from the S&M-ish side of costume designs that was going on in the sort of earlier movies?
Speaking as a man who clearly loves S&M, Ahmed Ali.
Yeah.
Sorry, he doesn't. Well,
the S&M stuff was related to, first of all, the costume designer, Norma Morcio, was like, she put all that stuff in with all the big American shoulder pads, which at the time, that look in the 80s was big shoulders was, you know, kind of that look, and it was sort of, she was then developing it into an absurd degree. Also, there was a convergence of style with 2000 AD Judge Dredd and that stuff with the big shoulder pads as well. So that kind of look was more in the air. And because the group, there was the gang that were terrorizing the sort of, the white clad liberals, if you like, inside the compound. Then you've got the kind of wild boys, you know, the William Burroughs wild boys types of gangs outside. What a subsect of the gang was called the Gay Boy Berserkers. So there were a couple of other ones. It's sort of, there was something worked out in Mad Max 2 where you had one big gang, but you had the Gay Boy Berserkers, which Wes, the character with the thing and the assless chaps, was part of. So that made sense for that gang to have that kind of gear. In this one, we are dealing with the gang are basically a bunch of, if you like, mind-controlled war boys for Immortan Joe. And, you know, we went through different costume looks. I did come up with a white look, you know, the one kind of which they went for in the end. That wasn't, you know, to do with me. And also I developed another look, which was more Mad Max 2, big shoulder pad kind of look. There were a couple of others, you know, we sort of messed around with them. But there was a lot of information there for whoever actually came on as the costume designer. I can't remember her name. she took the white look and removed, and you know, if you look at a lot of gangs now, MS-13 gangs in America, those Latino gangs, they're bare from the waist up. There was an element of where they're wearing black gloves and stuff, which I wasn't too keen on, because there was a sense of satirizing toxic male behavior into, you know, they looked like demented Chippendales, you know, at least you didn't put cuffs on them, but the black gloves, you know, they were, thankfully didn't have bow ties. But that, there was a bit of that, and there was also the Day of the Dead, if you like, the skull motif, which I personally, it was starting to get used a bit by then, the Day of the Dead stuff, and I was thinking, we've seen that. See, my thing is not, if it's been in another movie, we don't do it. So the actual final costume designs were, you know, years after me, so, but there was... what I developed was, in terms of the white look, white skin look, I developed bullet hole tattoos. So all of them had a bullet hole at the center of their face with, you know, when you shoot into glass, you get all those cracks around a bullet hole. And they had these cracks, and they would join up to another bullet hole, and the cracks would lead to another one. And the idea is that for each kill, they got a bullet hole stamped on them, and their faces would be covered, and then the bodies would have this spider web of bullet hole tattoos. Now they drop that and then put on engine part scarification. It doesn't really, it's hard to, you see it in the film, but it's a sort of deeper detail, you'll catch it, but it doesn't, it's not really that overt. To get back to your question, like the gay boy berserkers of number two went into SM gear, and then the war boys, formerly called the necro boys, the war boys were, you know, more like a brainwashed youth cult, and it was more deriving from current gang wear, like, you know, where they're naked from and they wear baggier trousers and things like that. That's how that came. I like the simplicity of where they put half, you know, the top part of the head, they just rub engine grease on it, and you saw Furiosa do it at one point. So that, you know, there were nice things like that.
Cool. Well, that's amazing, Brendan. Well, thank you so much for talking to us. I mean, this has been a real, you know, delight and pleasure just listening to you talk about the film. I mean, just very quickly in the 2 minutes that we've got, like when you saw, obviously, you know how we felt when we saw the film, but when you finally got to watch it in the cinema, did you feel like you'd achieved what you and George set out to do, like Road Warrior 2.0?
I'll tell you a really nice story. Bear in mind that probably my favorite ever movie is Mad Max 2, Road Warrior. And, you know, Mel Gibson, George Miller, you know, whatever, right? So I saw Mad Max Fury Road at the premiere in Hollywood. And I guess George must have manipulated this, but I was sitting, you know, in the premiere at Man's Chinese Theater up on the balcony, and directly behind me on that seat is George Miller, and that seat is Mel Gibson. And we both all watched it together. And at the end of it, George put his hand on me and said, "Thanks, mate." And I went like that. And Mel Gibson went like that. And thinking, wow, you know, what a weird turnaround when you're a 20-year-old kid watching Blown Away by a Road Warrior. And then 20-odd years later, you get to see the one that you co-wrote and designed with George Miller. And there's the original Mad Max and the director both going like that to you. You think, wow, that was quite an experience. So that's how I saw it, with those two guys sitting behind me, which was pretty freaky.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, anyway, I mean, yeah. We got a result. We put out a great Mad Max film. We didn't disappoint everybody. You know, and I'm wishing George the best of luck with the new one. I hope it comes out well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again so much for talking to us, Brendan. That's a lovely note to end on. I mean, yeah, full circle, you know, totally. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, thanks once again. Arma, do you want to quickly say...
No, that was it. Thank you so much again, Brendan. That was eye-opening. Thank you so much.